Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, listeners. This is Marianne Stone with Bookends. This week on the show, we have an interview with Una Cruikshank about the Chthonic Cycle. Una won the first Best Non-Fiction at Ockham's, and you can catch her at August Word Festival in Christchurch. Then we have Michelle Leggett, Catherine Field Dodgson, talking about the beautiful painting and poetry of Emily Cummings and their publication Groundwork. And finally, we have Morin talking Central Otago Couture with Claire Renault, the book that she's published about the Eden Hoare fashion collection. Surprising and wonderful. Have a listen.
Una Cruikshank's book, The Chthonic Cycle, has been long listed for this year's Ockham Book Awards. And so it's really good that I am talking to you, Una, on on the day or the day after that you heard this great news.
Yeah, I'm delighted.
I bet you are. The book was described by Kellyanna Moore, who I trust, as beautifully curated, eclectically researched, and elegantly articulated, a jaunt around an eccentric collection of subjects. And it was a book that I really enjoyed being able to read on holiday because my daughter had snatched it off me and read beforehand. So we could spend the time... I could spend the time stopping and discussing things with her. So, you know, it's such a well-researched piece of work and recognised as such. But I think you need to tell us about what this collection of essays
sure, I'll do my
is
best,
about.
First, I just wanted to say thank you, and it's been such a surprise and a delight to hear that people are reading it with their friends or family or other loved ones, like they're reading it aloud, which is not something I pictured would actually happen when I was hunched over my keyboard like a little gargoyle writing this thing. So the social side of it is so lovely. So the collection is, it's 10 essays loosely themed around organic gemstones, which are things like coral, pearls, amber, which used to be alive in some sense and have become a luxury item, a jewellery item usually. And I love to start with a single item and then sort of follow its journey as far as I can through like natural history and then into human history. To craftspeople, to capitalism. And it's also in large part about being afraid of death, which might seem like a stretch, but I promise it does sort of make sense to integrate these two big topics. I think each of these items that I've chosen is just an entry point. It's sort of an excuse to spiral outwards into a bigger and bigger sphere of investigation. There's always so many little tangents or big tangents available once you start to learn a great deal about a topic.
Yes, because it seemed my daughter, who was read it just before me, she wondered if you looked into your jewellery box and you obviously have an interest in things like jet and coral and pearls and amber and all the things that we actually shared. You know, proclivities that we shared, and those sparked off because it must have been kind of one or two things that sparked off this.
The very first one that I wrote in this style and that led to the whole collection was the one about amber. And it really was kind of a bolt out of the blue. Like, I thought I would dash off this essay very quickly about a substance that I didn't know very much about, but I thought it was fascinating. I figured it would be a one-off, and it wasn't. It became an obsession. So amber led to ambergris, which led to me spending a lot of time reading about ocean ecosystems, which led to pearls and coral polyps. One thing just kind of spirals into another, which is fantastic. I have lots and lots and lots of research notes floating around on the cloud about all kinds of subjects, many of which don't even make it into the book. But someday they will. I mean, someday. I think no research is ever really wasted, you know.
It's all fertilizer. The thonic cycle, perhaps we should get you to explain what that means. I think I know what it means, but...
Yeah. One of my best friends, Stacey Teague, once told me that the title of my book makes her feel insane, which is like the funniest thing anyone's said about it. She absolutely hates it. But the thonic cycle is a play on the carbon cycle, which is one of the motifs in the book. So the way in which carbon is kind of reintegrated into living beings, we breathe it, we excrete it. When we die, our bodies break down and we release all that carbon into a larger global cycle and it begins again as something new. That is one of the motifs of the book. And I have a real attachment to the word thonic, which sort of refers to things of the underworld, things of the world of death or the world of night. It's, I think, a Greek word, at least originally of Greek extraction. But those concepts that there's like another world kind of mirroring this one, and it's a dark underground world, like a mine, for example. Mines make a number of appearances, as do caves and graves and so on in the book. That's kind of a universal concept. Like there's so many different cultures in which there is a dark underworld or an inverse world. And I began when writing about Jet, which is kind of a stone of death and memorialization and communion with the afterlife. I began thinking of this phrase, the thonic cycle, rather than the carbon cycle, as a cycle of things being buried underground and eventually coming to light again. Kind of a parallel to that physical cycle of carbon molecules.
Well, of course, yes, of course it does.
Thanks.
But I've read the book, but I think it will make sense to people listening as well, because a lot of these substances or materials have been formed by being underground, things like Jet.
Under enormous pressure for a very, very long time. Often.
Exactly. And then they've been used in jewellery and objects that have gone into graves because they have this mythical or religious, they've become these kind of icons, totems, whatever, that people have placed in graves. So you're right, there's a really interesting, there's a number of interesting cycles going on. Jet was probably my daughter's entry into your book, because she has been to Whitby because she was researching things to do with what goes on in Whitby, and she has a great love of Jet jewellery. She only has two small items, but I think she'd love to have more. But, you know, there is, that's a fascinating place, because we have this.
I'm so jealous and envious that she got to go to Whitby. I still haven't been. I was writing, as I mentioned in the book, during one of the lockdowns, and it became a bit of an obsession.
So Jet, and then there's, I mean, a lot of the materials and objects that you're talking about were extracted. I mean, a lot of raping and pillaging went on in the extraction and then the eventual ownership of a lot of these things. And then we have James Cook coming from Whitby, who then came across and is identified with many of us as bringing a colonial culture here that did a bit of raping and pillaging as well.
Sure did, yeah.
So
Yeah, it's an interesting tie. I don't really know what to make of it. It seems somehow to be significant, but I don't know what the significance is, except that, yeah, everything is connected somehow. It does seem significant in some odd way that first contact between Pākehā and Māori was specifically like people from Whitby, the hometown of Jet and vampires and goths and all kinds of peculiar qualities. It was a very isolated place, I think, right up until James Cook's lifetime. It's very odd that it was a Whitby coal ship, I think, the Endeavour.
That's what's so fascinating about writing in this kind of genre is you must, as you say, your research takes you in so many different directions, and then you've got to somehow bring it down and make it all cohere in
a lot of boiling
in an essay.
Down, yeah.
Yes.
My notes in my original essays sprawled even more than the finished book does. There's a lot of stuff that gets left out, which is sometimes a bit heartbreaking. It's there in the background somewhere. It's humming around in the background, and perhaps I'll be able to use it someday. I just really loved and appreciated being able to spend such a long time obsessing over these very specific substances or topics, and just reading and researching and getting like 10 books at a time out of the local library system and driving everyone crazy for months talking about it.
Oh, you must have. Yes, you must have been saying, guess what? Did
you
know
believe
that?
Where James Cook came from? And everyone's like, ugh, who cares?
So can you work on a number of essays at a time, or do you have to focus very much on the one?
I'm currently trying to work on an entire collection all at once, because it's going to be like even more coherently themed. But previously when I was writing this collection, I was writing one at a time, and it was like, they took years to put all of these together.
And at the time you were doing your master's in creative writing?
For part of it, yeah, for a year of it. The oldest essay in this book is actually more than 10 years old, the final essay, which I kind of slotted in because I realized it fitted very beautifully with the rest of the book. The newest is brand new. I actually submitted it to the publisher after the rest of the manuscript. So it's kind of amazing that it all fits together as well as it does. I did write several of these essays as part of my MA in creative writing at the International Institute of Modern Letters, which I was very, very lucky to attend in 2019. I took a year off my career to just get better at writing and think very, very hard about writing. And that's such a rare privilege and a gift. I will forever be grateful that I got to do that.
And so much input into the actual craft of putting the essays together, I bet.
Yeah, and so much exposure to types of writing that I wasn't familiar with, styles, genres, philosophies. Even the fact that like the creative nonfiction and the poetry class are one class. The day that I arrived, I didn't understand why that would be. I thought that those were almost opposites, but they're not at all. They're very fertile when you put them together.
Yes, you are a poet, aren't you? I'm looking for a quote that I wrote down where you, I think you addressed us, the reader, by saying you can't be accused of letting a poet lie to you.
Little Bjork joke there.
Yeah, so you need, well, I think, you know, being a poet is such a useful thing when you're describing things, because you have to be so accurate and so creative in how you get across a fact, shall we say.
Yeah, the quality of observation as well, I think, is something I've learned a lot about from poets.
What are your favourite? You say you started with amber, but what are your favourite jewellery pieces?
Ooh, That is a very fun question. I have a few pieces of jet, same as your daughter. I get mine from Trade Me. So if she is looking, it's a great place to go to buy jewelry that's kind of unfashionable, like, you know, old antiques and like grandma's jewelry that nobody wants anymore. So I get most of my things off of Trade Me. Yeah, I have some jet beads that I'm really, really fond of. I am currently, people can't see, but.
No, but I was going to ask you about what you were wearing.
I'm wearing a few Egyptian pieces that were made, I think, for the tourist market in the mid-20th century. So I have this silver scarab and I have a long string of faience. I think that's the word, scarabs.
Yes.
And a French jet, which is just glass necklace as well. I do really like pearls still, even though I've learned a lot about how kind of cruel and horrific the pearl industry is.
Well, that surprised me.
Pretty much always has been. Yeah. I still have a bit of a guilty attachment to pearls. And I don't know whether you've heard about it, but in Wellington, there's an exhibition right now of the jewellery made by Vivienne Westwood, which I just went to see a week ago and absolutely loved it. I would recommend it to anybody that's listening and able to get there. It's so good. She uses every material under the sun, like Coke cans and straw and also diamonds and pearls. And it's an amazing, like, yeah, just a clash of everything, high and low and so on.
Yes, I would love to see that. Today I picked a piece that's got a tiny bit of coral in it because
oh, yeah.
Wearing coral, it was given to me, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty sure, because it came from Tunisia, that is possibly a piece of real coral, not.
Yeah.
But I know that, you know, it is not necessarily okay to be wearing things like coral.
Well, I think if it's an antique or if it's older from, like, before like it became really unsustainable, I think that's fine. Like I said, wear a lot of antiques myself. I have a couple of little pieces of coral. And again, I'm sure that's from like years and years and years ago. It's recycled or it's just a very old piece to begin with. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't advise buying new coral because it's an endangered species. Is that the word? It's endangered in general.
Well,
it's not sustainable right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, if it's an older piece you already had or it was already in the world long ago, I think that's fine.
I suspect it was given to me recently, so I'm not sure about that. But, I mean, part of what you're pointing out in this book is referring back to pearls. I hadn't known how much, you know, how slaves were forced to dive constantly, that the pearls, you know, they've virtually cleaned out the world of pearls in various areas. So much of the luxury items that have come from these materials have really dark and dreadful histories and continue to, really, don't they?
They do. Luxury is a fascinating and very, very disturbing topic. As you mentioned, it continues to be, whether it's blood diamonds or blood minerals, things like cobalt, gold, all kinds of mineral wealth extracted from so-called developing countries. Is just a site of terrible exploitation. I've been learning a little bit about the Congo just recently, kind of set off by seeing a film called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, which I really recommend. It's a little bit like my book in the sense that it's like collage style, like the way it's montaged together is incredibly like dynamic and colorful and loud, but it's telling this like very, very disturbing story of the Western exploitation of Congo for mineral wealth. That story continues, definitely, of luxury items coming from like the worst conditions you can pretty much imagine, from the hands of the poorest people in the world, straight up the ladder to the richest.
Well, I have to congratulate you on pulling all these things together and making it such a readable and beautifully written and challenging book. And I have to just finish very quickly with the cover. It's not only got an intriguing title, but it's got one of the best covers in New Zealand publishing, at least last year. I'd say it's fantastic.
That is wonderful. My friend Sasha Francis did the artwork. We worked together on it. The idea was mine, but all of the work was hers.
Well, I can just encourage people, they can't see it, but please go and find this book and you will be drawn by the cover, I can promise you. The book is called The Thonic Cycle. It's by Una Cruikshank and it's published by Te Heringa Waka Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Groundwork, the art and writing of Emily Cumming Harris, has been described as a labour of love for poet Michelle Leggett and researcher Catherine Field Dodson. I know, and we know, Michelle very well from all the years of wonderful poetry. She was the New Zealand Poet Laureate in 2007 through to 2009. She received the Prime Minister's Award for Literary Achievement in Poetry in 2013, and in 2017 she was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of New Zealand. Catherine Field Dodson has a very familiar name to me, but she whakapapas to Ronga Whakaata Ngāi Ngāi Tamanuhiri Te Aitanga Mahaki. And she wrote a master's thesis in 2003, which was the first detailed study of Emily Harris's exhibiting practices. What a wonderful team to put this book together.
You're always standing on the shoulders of those.
I know you are. Okay.
Not just of Catherine in particular here, in this case, the book could not have been written without her. But we actually need to go back several decades because people did know about Emily. And in fact, there were a couple of attempts to publish her work, her diaries notably. And we do need to acknowledge that people have thought of trying to get her out of the shadows, if you like. But it was only when this very big effort, it's taken us 9 years to do this, and to get in the same frame her writing, which is really important to me, even though there's not many poems, but there's a lot of writing, to get her as a writer and as an artist in frame together. People have known about the art, particularly art historians have, for a long, long time. But to be able to frame, to get the frame that encompasses both the art and the writing, that was my dream, and we've accomplished it with this book. I'm very, very happy with the result.
Well, when you see all the collected artworks and the archival pieces, the kind of detective work that is clear when you read the book. Catherine, tell us a little bit about that process.
That's my favourite kind of researching. I call it treasure hunting. I'm the sort of person that my favourite place to be is in the reading room at the Turnbull Library or in the National Library hunting through microfiche, looking for little glimmers of Emily. But also, I've got to acknowledge that this project, it wouldn't have been possible without the sheer amount of digitisation that's happened, even in just the last 5 years since I came on board. Because of papers past and all the newspapers that have been digitised, that's been the game changer. We've been able to find so many mentions of the Harris family. So we've done the good old-fashioned hard research, going and looking at collections, talking to amazing librarians and collections managers who know their stuff inside out, and they always point us in fabulous directions. But we were also fortunate to be able to tap into the Harris family descendants. And they've been phenomenal. They are a family of archivists. They have kept things from the 1860s. They have diaries. They have notebooks. They have sketches. They have paintings. And they shared everything with us. And that has made this project really rich, being able to tap into
that material has not been seen before, or very little of it. When we found the family, the descendants of Emily, she wasn't married, but she had two sisters who did marry, and the descendants come from those two sisters. So it took a while, this is sort of 4 to 5 generations later, it took us a little while to find them, and the breakthrough came when we looked in the white pages for a particular surname. Inevitably, a man who had the name, whereas his daughters had all married and had different names. Once we found them, they were very pleased to see us. We were very pleased to see them. It's been a wonderful relationship, ongoing.
Michelle, fill us in about Emily Cunningham Harris and maybe something about her artistic talents, because not just a painter, but a poet as well.
Yes, all right. So the kind of pocket description is that she is best known as a botanically accurate watercolourist of Indigenous Aotearoa plant life. We've uncovered something like 200 surviving images, but there's a 53-year exhibition history. And she painted basically all her life. And as far as we can determine, she also wrote all of her life, not poetry in particular, but certainly letters and diaries, many of which have survived. The poems are, of course, what drew me first. The very first thing we uncovered at Pukeariki in New Plymouth back in 2016 were some little manuscript books copied out by her, in which were two poems from behind the lines of the Taranaki War of 1860-61. This was an extraordinary find. I had no idea that there was a young woman, she was 23 at the time, that she was living through the Taranaki War. She had lost her brother 3 months or so before these poems were written. And they're both very good poems. One is a satire and the other is really a kind of covert elegy for her brother. And it was those two poems and the hope of discovering more, because she talked about writing poems. She, like Emily Dickinson, she wrote poems and put them in letters to her friends and family. And we were hopeful right at the beginning, and still, that more of these handwritten poems written to family and friends, so the contexts are all right there, we're still hopeful that more of them might come to light. But in the whole 9 years, we've got those two, and then we've got 8 much smaller, shorter poems from probably the 1880s or 90s that she wrote to accompany one of her most extraordinary productions. It's called New Zealand Mountain Flora, 28 beautiful watercolours of alpine flora. At that point in time, the 1890s, early 1900s, not really accessible except for hardy botanists going out into the mountains. And Emily produced this book and had great hopes of having it published in England. And among the 28 plates, there are 8 of these little poems in typescript. And that's the only place they occur. We've never been able to find any of the 10 surviving poems anywhere published. She wasn't interested in doing it like that. It was handwritten stuff and typescript stuff. If she had been able to publish New Zealand mountain flora? Well, maybe they would have seen the light of day in a publication, but that didn't happen.
Catherine, she was quite, what can I say? She was good at making sure that her work was displayed and exhibited, though, wasn't she?
She was the consummate marketer of her work as well. So she's an absolute force when you look at what she's doing. As Michelle said, her 53-year career of exhibiting, when you line them all up like that, I'm pretty confident in saying there's no other woman in this time period doing the same thing. You have women coming in and out at various points along the way, but she's there the whole time, making sure that her works are being seen. And if you want to talk about the detective work side of things, a lot of her paintings don't have dates on them. And so something Michelle and I were really keen to do was to try and make sense of them and tell the stories behind them. And they're scattered in different collections all around the country. So you've got a few in Nelson. You've got the bulk of them in the Alexander Turnbull Library in Wellington. There's 63 there. You've got a few in Pukeariki and New Plymouth. And then the family has a few. So we had to sort of put these paintings all back together. And because of the research we did, we were able to pull out stories around a bunch of them, which was really neat. And it shows she's not just a watercolorist. You know, that's traditionally how she's written about. But there's a whole chunk of her work which is missing, which are all the decorative items that she produced in the 1880s. So that's where she's painting on fans and tabletops and screens and embroidered drapes. All those sorts of items that haven't survived the test of time. And then in 1906, she does what I call a giant pivot, and she starts painting these giant, 1 meter tall, some of them, oil paintings for the 1906 International Exhibition in Christchurch. And I have to admit quietly that when I first saw those oil paintings and I saw the signature Emily Harris, I said, "That's not Emily Harris. What are you talking about?" And then, you know, had to put all the research behind it, and it is Emily. She's just suddenly changed track, and she's making these giant oil paintings that are designed to be seen. And the space they must have taken up on the wall would have been phenomenal. You know, we sit here hoping that one day a photo might turn up. You know, we're constantly hoping that poems might turn up, photos might turn up, some of the missing works might turn up, and they still do. They still appear in auctions.
Yeah.
We're keeping our eye out. She's fascinating.
That's what Groundwork's job.
Yes,
really.
Yes. I was just going to say that. That's, you know, partly why you've called it Groundwork.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It's her groundwork. You know, she is, she's right there at the beginning of creative endeavour by Pākehā women in this country. But it's also our groundwork, just finding her again. She's always been there. And in her day, she was well known, and she saw to it that she was. But when you live to be 88 and you're in, you know, necessitous circumstances, no money at all, and the art fashions change, and you can disappear very easily. And that's why I think it's taken so long to dig back, find her, and find out just how important, we think she is, to what's going on in this country in terms of art, in terms of botany, in terms of, you know, diary writing. She covers quite a range of activities.
Yes, it does, give us a glimpse into life for a woman back in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And
definitely.
Also, what is going on in so many different facets of society. Catherine, how would you describe her style, her artistic style, or what is it that draws you to her work?
I'm a giant sucker for botanical art. Always have been, absolutely adore botanical paintings, especially scientific botanical illustration. And so I first became acquainted with Emily's work when I was at university, and I just remember finding the works of Emily Harris and Sarah Featon, Georgina Hetley, and then Alice Rowan. You know, there's a number of New Zealand women in the colonial period who are painting Indigenous flora. Something I'd say about Emily, though, is that her style changes. It's not static. So she doesn't just stay painting, you know, single specimens on a white background. She really mixes it up. And we were caught by surprise, actually, with the 1879 paintings that she did for the International Exhibition in Sydney. No one had ever found those paintings before, and that's something that we were able to piece together because we found a photograph at Te Papa, and they're slightly out of focus in the background of the photograph, but that's them, and we can trace a number of them to collections around the country. And I had always thought that they would be white backgrounds, single specimens, but they're not. They're, you know, multiple flowers, berries. They're beautiful. They're moving. They're, one of the words I used to Michelle to describe one of them was shimmering, you know. But then she can switch and she can produce really big, more akin to scientific botanical illustration, depending on her audience is. Mm. And I think that's key to understanding her works, is that she switches depending on who she's marketing them to, or who has asked her to come in and produce the works.
And possibly that's the reason for the variation in size as well. The big watercolours at Turnbull, which are more like static specimens mostly, we think they're from the 1890s, and that's the period at which she was asked at least a couple of times to contribute these paintings to a meeting of the Nelson Philosophical Society. So imagine the gentlemen scientists are all there doing their talks about their botanizing trips, etc. And they're able, because this is basically right at the beginning of photography, so black and white photography is not really going to cut it. They're able to point to the wall of the meeting room in Nelson and say, thanks to Miss Harris, to whom we've shown our specimens, here are some beautiful watercolours of the plants that we've basically just discovered. It's quite a moment.
The ones she did of the plants that came back from the subantarctic islands, those are fabulous, aren't they? Because those are very dramatic plants.
Yes, they're very alien-looking, aren't they?
The
moment when we were able to find the specimens that had been collected by Thomas Kirk in the collection at Te Papa was just, I mean, that was one of the biggest light bulb moments, you know, and we can literally place the specimen next to the painting and say, we know she looked at it, she wrote about them in her diary. Mm. So here's what the dried brown specimen, slightly shriveled, looks like, and here's how she's brought it to life.
Yeah, it's the botanists have their descriptive language and she has her own visual descriptive language. And when you put the two together, it's quite magical. You know, the botanists give you all the information, but Emily gives you the artistic interpretation of that botany, and it's very special.
Well, it's very special what you two and your team, we need to acknowledge what a team effort this has been, but it is extraordinary what you've managed to discover about her. And the book itself, I mean, we just have to finish by saying what a beautifully produced book it is. It does complete honour to the work that you've put in and that she has done over the years.
If we say that Nicola Leggett, no relation, different spelling, when Nicola took the book on for Te Papa Press, she basically said to us, look, you know, this is the chance to bring Emily out of the archive, you know, where she's been all these years. This is our one shot. Let's make it a really good one so nobody will have to do this job again for quite a long time. We were very happy to hear that.
And we think that Emily herself would be really pleased.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Yeah. It's exactly 100 years since Emily Harris died in Nelson in 1925. And that was always our objective, to be able to bring her back into the light. If it took 100 years, well, it's taken 100 years, but I think we can say that she's out in the world again.
She's shimmering out there. She's shimmering. Thank you both for your time, and thank you both for all the work and love that you've poured into this project.
Thank you. Ngā mihi nui.
Ngā mihi nui. Groundwork, The Art and Writing of Emily Cumming Harris by Michelle Leggett and Catherine Field Dodson is published by Te Papa Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
I was young in the 70s and keen on fashion and, like many, made most of my own clothes. I actually heard about Eden Hoare back in those days, the farmer down in central Otago, and his penchant for women's high fashion. Posh frocks, really, in those days. And I've always been intrigued by him. So this new book, Central Otago Couture, The Eden Hoare Collection, is a wonderful way of answering all the questions that I might have had about him. Claire Reno is one of the authors of this book. She is Senior Curator of New Zealand Histories and Cultures at Te Papa and the author of a number of significant and beautiful books on New Zealand fashion history. That includes Dressed, which won the New Zealand Book Award for Illustrated Nonfiction in 2022 at the Ockhams. Claire, you have known about Eden for many years as well, obviously in your role, but even before that.
Yes, well, before that, I remember my dad worked in the wool industry. He was a lecturer at Massey University in wool technology, and I remember him talking about the collection. And it must have been on Country Calendar or something like that. So I had this distant memory of it when someone else, I think when we were working on the Dress Circle, brought that collection up. And it's like, oh, that rings a bell. Yeah.
So first of all, we need to know about Eden. He was a farmer, as we said, a merino farmer. He was a returned serviceman. And he had this absolute love for and interest in high fashion.
He certainly did. He's an amazing person. You know, in many ways, he was a very good farmer, quite a quiet man in many ways, but, you know, we often call him an extroverted introvert. And he had a housekeeper at the time who turned into a partner for quite a number of years, and she worked for him on the farm, but she was also a part-time model, and he would go into town with her, and while she chose her gowns, and they would go to fashion shows. And he recalls going to one where he felt very, very uncomfortable until he began to notice that the garments that were being modelled were all made of wool. And he made that connection between what he did and his everyday life as a farmer and what he was seeing. And that really intrigued him. And when he first began collecting, what he was really interested in was collecting garments made from wool, but also from suede and leathers, to be able to show fellow farmers, because I think he was really taken. It seemed to really surprise him actually seeing this product, because as he said, you know, as a farmer, he just cared about the sheep, selling the wool, taking the money, and didn't think much beyond what his product was actually turned into. And he really wanted to, educate other farmers and people visiting his station as to actually what happened with their products and the sort of whole cycle.
And that turned into, you wouldn't call it an obsession, but it turned into an interest and went well beyond being a hobby, really.
I think so. I think you could almost call it an obsession. he amounted a collection of sort of over 250 very spectacular garments. And he went from, you know, these stunning hand-woven woolen garments, really imaginative, beautiful leather and suede garments, but also a lot of garments made from, you know, those, you know, it was 70s, absolutely stunning synthetic fabrics, but, you know, haute couture type of fabrics fill that collection. So
There was a lot of adornment. There was a lot of, you know, there's peacock feathers in some of those outfits. There's not fur necessarily, because they are kind of evening wear. Not all of them, but
not all of them. There's
special occasion.
Yeah, he really. That's what I sort of love about the collection. I always think, again, because you know he lived on a sheep station near Ranfurly called Glenshee, and you know Central Otago is the most magnificent landscape, but it's also pretty harsh, isn't it? And I always think of his property as like this strange, this wonderful oasis in the middle of Central Otago, and it was a place full of dreams. You know, like he re-landscaped his property. He grew, you know, he had a beautiful garden. He grew roses. He had this amazing modernist fountain that had all different settings. And then, you know, he had this amazing museum where visitors could go in, and if you fitted a gown, you could try it on, and there was like a stage set up. So, you know, so they are fantastical gowns. And again, with the designers he was collecting, he's got amazing collection of gowns by Vinca Lucas and Kevin McCann, who, you know, are Auckland-based designers, but designers that were, you know, really entrepreneurial and, again, had big dreams, really wanted overseas success, but, you know, they were in New Zealand. And, you know, I think Vinca had plans on sort of moving to Hollywood at one stage. She opened up in the Middle East. Kevin opened up in Sydney as the, you know, Sydney Opera House was opening, because he knew there'd be all these new glamorous events that women would need garments for. So, yeah, it's and then there's a lot of garments by designers who were competing in the Benson and Hedges Awards. So again, they had big dreams of making it in the industry. So that feels for me what that collection is. It represents all these ambitions and dreams and a desire for, you know, for glamour, because they are glamorous garments. You know, they're not your everyday streetwear, and they're definitely you know, they're not for wallflowers.
No, there's some quite avant-garde pieces in there from younger designers. So he didn't, I mean, he had designers that he bought from consistently, but he did sort of make some different choices from time to time.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, sort of very on the money. Like, he's got a beautiful piece by Susan Holmes from the late 70s from the Benson Hedges, and it was from a new category called the Fantasy Award. And it's sort of, you know, it predates but sort of points to the direction of wearable arts. So, you know, you get there's a number of garments by designers that are bordering on that, moving into wearable arts or more conceptual. So, you know, he definitely was happy to take a risk.
The interesting thing is that you've been involved in the fact that the Central Otago District Council now owns that collection.
They certainly do. What other council owns 250 glamorous frocks?
I don't know any. I certainly would be discouraged in today's political environment from that sort of nice to have rather than. But what a wonderful thing. They're all kept and they're maintained and looked after.
It is, and I think their ambition is the same as Eden's. You know, Eden opened his museum along with, you know, he had exotic animals, so he had a petting zoo. He took people on sort of safari around his property. You know, he wanted to draw people to Central Otago, and that's really the council's aim now, is to, you know, promote this collection and Eden and his love of central Otago is another way of drawing people into the area.
And this book is part of that whole a vision, isn't it? Because it's a stunning book. It's beautiful. Tell us about putting it together.
Oh, the book's been very fun. I mean, the reason it is absolutely so stunning is really because of the wonderful Derek Henderson, who's one of New Zealand's top fashion and landscape photographers. He's based in Sydney now, but we approached him in about 2017 or 18 to see if he'd be interested in working with the collection and photographing some of it. And we just did a small collection at that stage, probably just about 14 garments in the landscape. But he just absolutely loved the project. And, you know, he's done this pro bono. It's out of passion. He's loved the collection and the story. He loves central Otago. And, yeah, he came back last year and did a big photo shoot over a couple of weeks all around the central Otago area. So, you know, he captures that magnificent landscape. And, again, with Eden, you know, he was someone that travelled a lot. But he talked about, you know, he was always drawn back to central Otago. That's really where his soul was. And it is such an extraordinary landscape, you know, much of it man-made. But again, a landscape sort of made by dreams, you know, with the gold miners and, you know, people trying to make a life there.
There's a grandeur in it that is quite awe-inspiring at times down there, isn't it? And it's lovely to see those garments restyled in a way that's quite contemporary. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, people do still laugh at this. You know, the 70s still doesn't have, probably 70s and early 80s still don't have a great reputation in the fashion world. It's sort of seen as a bit naff and, it's dated, but when you put them on a again, because I work in a museum, so whenever we display garments, they have to go on a, you know, a dress form or a mannequin. People aren't allowed to wear them. With this collection, because it's not in a museum, there's a little bit more flexibility, and because Eden loved seeing the garments worn, you know, he really valued being able to see them come to life. We felt that this sort of honoured his, you know, his point of view. It's been quite a magical experience actually seeing them on people and in the landscape, and that they go from, you know, you look at something in a box and you think, oh, that's a bit fusty, or I'm not sure about that. But then you take it out, get some life into it, put it on one of those gorgeous models, and it just, you know, transforms, and all that datedness just sort of begins to disappear.
Yeah, you see something completely different. I mean, I was never a great fan of, was it crochet? Well, it was definitely crochet back in that day. I thought it was awful. But there's a lovely piece that I think was in the Benson and Hedges, and it's got a snood and it's a creamy coloured thing. Is it crocheted? It's a long
dress.
Yes,
it's crocheted. It's a beautiful tubular dress by June Mercer.
Yeah, but seeing it in the book and the way it's been photographed and on the model just looks absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
That's actually one of my favourite garments and end of the day, and one of my favourite photos actually. Because, you know, it's photographed in a beautiful evening light as well. And I know when we first got that out and showed it at an exhibition at the Douse a few years ago, you know, somebody said, oh, I could just see Courtney Love in that. It sort of had, to them, it had a grunge aspect. You know, it was still quite contemporary. But the way Derek's photographed it on Alana, it's got a whole other look. But, yeah, it's quite a timeless piece.
Yes, I had to rethink my aversion to crochet.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's a very – and she used a fleece. It's one fleece. It's all, none of it's dyed, and she just, you know, the way she spun it and crocheted it, it goes from the dark wool to the light. So it's beautifully graduated, and it sort of looks like snakeskin the way she's done it. And then you go from that, which is really quite subtle, to absolutely wonderfully flamboyant. Another favourite is the Joe Dunlap jumpsuit Electra, which has, you know, these, I think they're about 3 meter wide flares. And Nahuia Williams is wearing that, and she's just sort of like striding through the landscape. And she, you know, it's got quite a space sci-fi feeling, but she, yeah, she looks like she's this sort of science fiction queen that's just sort of beamed down into central Otago, and she's taking it on.
Well, I just congratulate you and your fellow writer, Jane Malthus, is it?
Malthus, Jane Malthus.
Yeah, and Derek, and to Papa, of course, who published the book, because you really have done Eden proud, I'd say. It should draw people to the collection and to central Otago.
Yeah, I hope it does all of those things and gives people a little bit of, you know, again, rethink the 70s and 80s, give them a new appreciation. And, I think it's what I love about New Zealand fashion history. You know, we have so many interesting little quirky stories and unique stories in our history that we should embrace and celebrate.
Yes, well, you'll probably see a revival of 70s-style couture now, thanks to your book. Or we'll get out old pieces that might be. I had a really stunning Susan Holmes coat.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Knitted and with bits of fabric, and I wore it till it absolutely fell off me. So I'm sorry it's gone, but it lingers on.
Well, it's been good to wear to, you know, that's a good sign of a good outfit, isn't it, if it's been worn to death with love by someone. Yeah.
Thank you, Claire. It's the book is called Central Otago Couture, the Eden Hall Collection. It's been written by Jane Malthus and Claire Reno, and the photographs are by Derek Henderson. And it's published by Te Papa Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.